supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
3 to 4 times the cost. In sports, Flyers are in Calgary tonight. Action begins at 10. And the Drexel Dragons have won 16 games in a row now. They visit Old Dominion today at 4. They've clinched the top seed in the Colonial Athletic Association tournament. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, how come you don't see more peanuts growing in people's home gardens? We'll explain why and tell you what it takes to get a bountiful harvest out of this unusual crop. We're also going to talk to our old friend Art Walk on the eve of this year's Philadelphia Flower Show, talking about forcing those beautiful blooms that you see in the show and how you can do the same thing at home. That's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Laura, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm calling from Philadelphia.
Okay. Well, then, if that's the case, you know the drill. What neighborhood?
Fishtown.
Oh, I went to high school with a whole bunch of guys from Fishtown. I say guys because I went to the Northeast Catholic High School for boys.
Okay.
We had a lot of Fishtonians in our classes. What can we do for Laura from Fishtown?
Since Friday, just this past week, my rose bushes are being damaged by an excavation. Now, I have some rose bushes that are 8 or 9 years old, and the excavators building a new house built right up to our property line. One of the rose bushes is extremely precarious, and if we hadn't tied it up to a fence across the garden, it would have fallen into the pit. So how can I save these bushes? What do I need to do?
It's like a Victorian chapter romance or something. You know, the roses are falling into the pit. I hate to be overly obvious, but when this construction started, why didn't you dig up the roses and hold them somewhere until the construction was over?
It just happened this past Friday.
What, you went to bed on Thursday night and everything was fine, the birds were singing?
Yes,
and then on
exactly.
On Friday morning, there's 8 steam shovels shaking your house?
Exactly. You should have. The noise was horrendous.
I'll bet. Okay, so here's what you do in a situation like this. Because let's be honest, the roses that you were growing, yes, they are building, we'll take your word, they're building right up to the property line. But apparently so were the roses, right? They were happening right up to the edge of your property line.
Yes, I mean, they weren't planted right at the edge, but by this time, the roots of the roses have spread equally out all around the bush, of course.
Right, right. Well, you're in luck, actually. This should not be too difficult, because roses are one of the easiest plants to move around. If you go to our website, for instance, and you look under M in our alphabetical archives for moving plants, I'm pretty sure the article's about roses. I haven't checked it lately. But they take this really well. So have you pruned them back at all to keep the canes from being beaten up by the steam shovels?
No, we didn't prune them in this season. However, they were pruned about a year ago.
That's perfect. I was afraid you were going to say you would prune them in the fall, but apparently you didn't, and you're
good. No, because I listened to Mike McGrath.
Good. Well, otherwise he's a bonehead, but he gets that one right. So this is a perfect time for you to get out there with the pruners. You can reduce these puppies in size greatly, which you're going to want to do, because then you're going to want to lift them out of the ground and take them somewhere and do what's called healing in. You don't even have to plant them. Just make a depression in the ground, put the roots in the depression, cover the roots with soil, and make sure it doesn't dry out. Keep it well watered. This is what professionals do when they have to hold plants for like a couple of weeks or a month or so. So what you want to do is you either want to heel them in the ground, or because you're in Fishtown, which is a row home community and space is tight, you might want to go out and get some nice big planters and fill them with a combination of soil-free mix and compost. And you could, for instance, even grow the roses in these planters this entire season. And then when things are all done and over with and they're all finished futzing next door, then you can replant them back in the ground in the fall, which is a great time to put new plants in the ground. But the basic answer is prune them back now, get them out of the ground now, and hold them someplace else.
When I prune, I can prune back a third of the mass?
You can go back to like a foot tall in a situation like this. This is an unusual situation. You want to reduce the weight of the plant so that you can handle it easily. You want to get rid of most of the thorns so you're not killing yourself. This is a case where I give you permission to whack your roses. Just don't go back further than a foot on each cane.
Okay, and how much of a root ball do I need to make sure
all of
I have
it.
All of it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Well, I really appreciate you taking my call. It's been extremely helpful, and you've made my day.
All right. Good luck, Laura. Take care.
Thank you, Mike.
1-888-346-9499. Peter, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Peter. How are you, man?
I am doing so well, I can barely stand it.
Okay, and where is this wonderful thing occurring?
Newark, Delaware, the other Newark.
All right, Peter in Newark, Delaware, what can we do you for?
I have two sets of Concord grapevines, one from my grandfather's farm outside of Kalamazoo, Michigan. Mike, this root must be 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The other one I bought from a local nursery to balance on a grape trestle that I have that is about 9 feet long and 5 feet wide. I've got about seven canes coming up both sides.
Right.
Now, in Michigan, we would get phenomenal grapes from these grapevines. You know, all summer long, Mom would make grape jam out of them. And I'll tell you, when you opened up that grape jam in February, it tasted like sunshine on toast in the middle of a Michigan winter. But now, in Delaware, my grapes turn yellow and shrivel up even before they've had a chance to turn purple. Some people have said, oh, what you need to do is you need to spray them with fungicide once a week and every time after it rains. I'm hoping you might have a recommendation that doesn't include that.
Oh, absolutely. The only problem, so to speak, with grapes that makes them seem so disease-prone is, like peaches, they are just incredibly lush plants. They just love to grow, and they grow too much. Now, I presume you are doing some late winter pruning of the dormant canes and vines, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We cut them back all the way down to about the top of the arbor.
Okay.
And then during the summer, they grow towards each other across that arbor.
Excellent. That sounds very good. One of the little known secrets of getting good grapes and avoiding disease problems is so ancient, it's ridiculous, but it's not passed on a lot. And that is, as the canes, as the vines produce their leaves and their fruit, you have to aggressively thin them the same way I have to aggressively thin the peaches on my wife's peach trees. We just had a question of the week recently about how much fruit do you really need to thin? That is, remove little baby fruits while they're forming to get big ones at the end. And our friend Lee Reich said in commercial agriculture, you remove 19 out of 20, which just, I mean, turned me white. I mean, it was like I thought I was doing good taking off every other fruit, and here I'm leaving them still crowded. And I could see they were still crowded. And you have a similar situation with your grapevines. If left to their own resources, as you know, they form a wall, a living wall. There's no space for air to flow through the clusters and the grape leaves. So the simple answer is, you want to remove both grape leaves and grape clusters in amounts that give airflow through the plant. You have to turn the wall into a slatted fence. Do you understand?
I do.
And then once that airflow can pass through the sections of the plant, you're not going to get those disease problems. You also want to make sure that there aren't a whole bunch of leaves laying on top of a cluster of grapes. Make sure there's airflow around there. But my understanding is, as with my peaches, aggression in removal is rewarded at the end of the season.
Well, fantastic. That's great, Mike, because my grape harvest last year was absolutely zero.
Last year we had the wettest summer in history in this part of the country, in many parts of the country. And a combination of having a lush grapevine and constant moisture is just bad news all around.
Right.
So that's another lesson for you, man. The wetter it is and the cooler the season, the more you have to be aggressive. The warmer it is, the more warm breezes we have blowing through, the less disease is going to be a problem. So pay attention to the physical look of the plant and the actual weather. Now that you know the equation, you can do this.
Will do. I'll get out my clippers and we'll prune like a madman.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Very good, Peter. Good luck.
Thanks again.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn first-time seed starters that having the right kind of equipment, including soil-free mix and good artificial light, are essential to success. Because garden soil and a so-called sunny windowsill are certain to produce puny plants. Or just plain dead ones. But don't go looking for all the details on how to correctly start your seeds in the A to Z Garden Answers section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with our old pal Art Walk, who will teach us how to force pretty flowers into bloom when we want, how to grow your own peanuts in your own backyard, and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden, made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee is a gardening resource featuring vegetables, flowers, videos, and more. The 2012 catalog is now available online at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY and You Bet Your Garden, the Delaware Home Show, presented by the Home Builders Association of Delaware, March 3rd and 4th at the Chase Center on the riverfront in Wilmington. WHYY's own Mike McGrath, the featured garden guru, will lead seminars including Getting Your Landscape Off Drugs and Growing the Best Tomatoes Ever. Delaware Home Show vendors will highlight the latest trends in garden and home products and service. For tickets, DelawareHomeShow.com. The Delaware Home Show. Dig it.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, peanuts are a very popular edible, and they're mostly grown here in the United States. Why don't you see them in more home gardens? We'll explore the answer when we talk about what it takes to grow these unusual underground legumes. And of course, we're going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to bring on our special guest, Master Bulb Forcer Art Walk. That's W-O-L-K, a noted exhibitor at the Philadelphia Flower Show and author of the brand new book, Bulb Forcing for Beginners and the Seriously Smitten. And of course, we're very proud to have Art in the studio on the eve of the 2012 Philadelphia Flower Show. Art Walk, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate being here.
The Philadelphia Flower Show has appreciated all the blue ribbons you've stolen from them over the years. Now, you are known at the Flower Show and in the area as a bulb forcer extraordinaire. Let's get your bragging rights out of the way. I understand you've won, what is it, a steeplechase grand champion?
It's called the Grand Sweepstakes.
And what did you have to do? How many judges did you have to pay off?
Well, to win the grand sweepstakes at the Philadelphia Flower Show, you have to enter at least 3 horticultural entries, which are basically just 3 plants or 4 bulbs, but you also have to enter 3 artistic entries. Even though I only had to enter 3 horticultural entries, the first year I entered 140 pots.
Okay. Not taking any chances, were we?
No, I had twice as many points as I needed. I drove my family twice as crazy as they need to be driven.
Okay. And now you have written a book that is going to teach other people how to drive people crazy.
Yes, yes.
Now, what is it about spring bulbs and forcing them that so appeals to you? Because obviously, if you go to the Philadelphia Flower Show or any major league flower show, you see all kind of, quote, house plants and tropical plants and in beautiful bloom, in addition to the daffodils and tulips and croci. What is it that led you to the bulbs?
I would say the flowers in the middle of winter. I started my garden life in an apartment when I first got married in the early 70s, but I still was cool enough to force bulbs inside. I learned how to do it, and it's still a thrill every single year. The first time I did it was probably 76. It's been a thrill every year since then, every time every flower opens.
I would wager that the entry to this hobby is having a limited outdoor space or no outdoor space at all, but wanting to be a part of the party. And you said you forced your bulbs in an apartment because it was cool enough. Could you not afford good heat? Was this a student apartment?
No, probably my first efforts at forcing, the stems got pretty long, the leaves got pretty long, because it was a little bit too warm. I tried to put it in the coolest place in our apartment, where I could put, where there was a window so that they would get some sun. But it was only a one-bedroom apartment, so it was catch-as-catch-can.
And do you remember what it was? What was the first?
The first thing I ever forced was daffodils and Scilla, Tubergeniana.
Okay, right. Scilla are little early spring bloomers.
Correct.
Now, you begin the book by talking about the dirt simplest bulb that people can bloom, and I'll let you take that from there.
Well, the very easiest are paper whites. These are the daffodils that originally were from the Mediterranean area and need virtually no cooling ahead of time. You just put them into pebbles or potting soil, and within 2 to 3 weeks, you have blooming flowers that will scent your entire home. Half the people love it, half the people hate it, but it is a very strong scent. They're about the easiest. They're so easy. I've actually seen them in bloom at the garden centers, in bud, ready to open. So you almost have to do nothing. They're the easiest bulb to force in the universe.
But they are different than all the other bulbs, right? Because most of the other bulbs come from these mountains in Turkey and Afghanistan. And if you visit these areas, you understand why a flower would develop a life cycle where it's only above ground for a month, and the rest of the time it's really good to be as deep below ground as possible.
Yes, they know how to protect themselves. The average spring blooming bulbs, like especially tulips and daffodils, are in mountainous areas where you would have to fight real hard to get a shovel all the way in the ground. They're rocks, they're pebbles, and it's perfect for them. In the winter, that's when they get their rainfall and the cold temperatures that they need. Spring comes on, they still get some rain, but by summertime, it's dry as dust in that area, which is just fine for these bulbs.
And I think that's one of the things that that most American gardeners fail to understand. They kind of get the idea that the bulbs have to go through winter, and that when winter is over, there's all kinds of timing cues for the bulbs to come up and bloom, and then the bulbs gradually, everything above ground disappears by itself. But then very few gardeners actually give the bulbs the hot, dry summer that their DNA requires from back in Turkey and Russia, right?
Especially for tulips, that's right. For all of these bulbs, after they're finished blooming, there's just green leaves, the flowers are gone, and if you want them to bloom every year, you have to let the leaves be exposed to sunlight, not bind them up, until they turn yellow. And then if you really want to be a good tulip grower, what a lot of people do is actually grow them in pots in the ground and then take them out in the summer and put them in a place where they get zero rainfall. And they're fine.
Now, of the classic spring blooming bulbs, the Dutch bulbs, the ones that need a chill, the ones that save us from the month of March, what would be the ones that a beginner would start with in their own home? They buy the bulbs in September, and what are you going to start them off with so they have some shot of success?
Not including paper whites, if we talk, I would say daffodils, especially. There's a lot of miniature daffodils that give you more than one flower per bulb. And even if the leaves, some of the leaves come up brown, you can still have enough leaves for the following year. And if it's a daffodil like Tete a Tete, you actually can have as many as 9 flowers inside one bulb. This is the flower that you usually see at supermarkets because they're easy to grow.
Yeah, and the miniature daffodils, I have to say, are some of my absolute favorites. You can get some really beautiful color combinations. It's not just a solid yellow. You've got shades of orange and all different levels of yellow. So, okay. So here's Joe Bulb Forcer starting for the first time. I know your advice is going to be go out and buy my book and follow it step by step. But they buy some miniature daffodil bulbs either online or at a store, and they have no outdoor space. They can't just take them home and plant them between Halloween and Thanksgiving. So walk us through what they can do, and I'll give you an edge. I'll give you that they have an extra fridge in the basement that they use as a beer fridge with no fruit in it.
Right. And the reason Mike is saying no fruit in it is because fruit gives off a gas called ethylene, which can rot the flower bud. You get wonderful leaves with no flowers. So if you can put your pots into a refrigerator that doesn't have fruit in it, set it for about 45 to 48 degrees, you know, somewhere in that neighborhood. And for some of the earliest miniature daffodils, I'd say for about 9 or 10 weeks, you can then take them out and force them inside your apartment. But there's even an easier way you can have these bulbs into bloom. You can buy what are called pre-cooled bulbs. Holland researchers have found is that you can take dry bulbs, put them in refrigeration at approximately 45 degrees for approximately 6 or 7 weeks. Then they send them to you, and you don't have to refrigerate them. They're much more expensive. I'd say about 40 to 50% more expensive, but that's a good way for people who are just starting out who don't have any space or an extra refrigerator is to look for pre-cooled bulbs.
Aren't they big down south where people don't have the chilling hours?
Absolutely. And the problem down south is, especially the further south you go, you don't have soil temperatures that get below 50 degrees, hardly at all.
What about just, again, if it's a defined beer fridge, can you just buy bags of bulbs, toss them in there, and then pot them up in January?
For certain kinds of daffodils and even tulips, yes, you can do this. And lilies as well.
But it is more foolproof to chill pots with soil.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, Art, you're going to be presenting some bulb forcing workshops at the Philadelphia Flower Show.
Yes, I'm going to one workshop and one lecture.
March 4th to 11th, the Philadelphia Flower Show. In addition to Art, you will see an amazing array of plants that have been forced by amateurs and professionals. It'll just make you salivate and want to do this yourself. I know Art very well. I know bulb forcing very well. This is a great book. It's even got an endorsement by me on the back. What more could you could you possibly want? The book is Bulb Forcing for Beginners and the Seriously Smitten. The author is Art Walk, W-O-L-K. Thanks for being on the show again, Art, and good luck at this year's flower show.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Mike.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Carol. Where are you?
I am in Lawrenceville, New Jersey.
I know where that is, right next to Princeton. What can we do for Carol in Lawrenceville?
Well, I have a problem with moss and lichen, but not on my lawn, on my roof.
Mm-hmm.
I have a shingles, just composition shingle roof. The side that is on the northeast, it mostly seems to be lichen. The northwest side, it's very pretty moss, but I can't believe these aren't damaging the shingles somehow. Is there some way, without using some awful chemical, that I can get rid of it?
Well, you really wouldn't even get rid of them for long with any kind of a chemical. I mean, you could spray them with something extremely nasty that would kill the plants that are there. But then somebody would have to physically remove the dead moss from the roof because it would look super ugly at that point. And you could
It's an interesting green right now.
Exactly. You could, you know, if you're worried about it, you can cut to the chase just by hiring somebody to come up who would, like, be a gutter cleaning service and raking the moss off of your roof. But here's what's happening. The area has become very acidic from rainfall and perhaps the types of trees. There must be trees heavily shading your roof.
Partially, I have one of the oldest American elms in the area, but other parts of the roof really are not shaded.
Well, that's unusual. How old are these shingles?
About 18, 19 years.
And are they 20-year shingles?
I think they're longer than that, but I'm not sure.
Here's the two situations. If you have 20-year shingles, it's about time for you to get a new roof.
Oh, don't say that.
Well, you know, these are, you know, people buy 20-year shingles and they don't do the freaking math. You know, they don't think, oh, in 20 years that means I'll need new ones. But that's what happened to us. My wife and I came home from Christmas dinner with one of our families, and Santa had brought us a special present late on Christmas Day, which was a waterfall in our kitchen. A water feature is just spectacularly beautiful. And the insurance company paid to have the kitchen redone. But because our 20-year shingles were 22 years old, we had to pay for the new roof. And had we not gotten a new roof, they would have canceled our insurance policy.
Ooh.
So these numbers get to be serious, which is why, by the way, when we did this, which was very recently, we bought 30-year shingles. But when we got the roof redone, we looked at the age of the shingles and other parts of the house. The house has been added on, country house. And over my office, it looks like Snow White's cottage. I have, facing the front of the road, the entire roof over there, which has a lot of structures coming out of it, is all moss. And when the guys were doing the roof, we had many spirited discussions of, is this moss damaging or is it just there? I know from my research on moss as an unwanted plant and as a replacement for lawns in shady spots that moss has no active root system. It doesn't burrow into shingles the way that ivy would and cause damage. It just kind of sits there. And in parts of Europe, it would be considered a green roof almost.
Literally.
Well, that's a green roof would almost be artificially, you know, putting a new structure on top of your existing roof frame and then planting it with something. So the moss has the potential to hold water behind it if it makes a wall. And then that wall of water, if it can't travel down the roof and get into the gutters, if it's trapped by the structure of the moss, then that water could work its way into your shingles and start causing mischief. You know, people who replace roofs are always going to say, well, you need to get it off there and you need to have the roof replaced, whereby I've been watching this one moss-covered roof of mine for 30 years now, and it's fabulous and we haven't had any problems. But I can see how if the moss was growing differently, it could trap water and cause problems. But in this case, the answer is if you want to get it off there, is simple removal. You would just get somebody up there. It has no root structure. And then just using a simple garden rake or hose, they could pull it all off very easily. And then if you like the moss, you could transplant it to shady spots on your garden. And then you could either spread wood ash on your roof or simply spray it with something alkaline that would create a pH that the moss would then not stick to. Modern shingles are often treated with some sort of alkaline material so that they will not support moss growth. Now, you know what your options are. You're welcome to leave it on. Like I said, the only danger is if it forms a solid structure, it could hold water behind it like an ice dam. So you want to be aware of that.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful. I'll stop worrying.
All right. You take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners who want to prevent crabgrass in their lawns this summer without using toxic chemicals that you must have weed-suppressing, all-natural corn gluten meal in hand before the soil temperature reaches 55 degrees Fahrenheit, 4 inches down. If you miss that window, the dormant crabgrass seeds will sprout and control will become close to impossible. But don't go running to your state extension website to check the crabgrass germination date in your area just yet, because we're coming right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what it takes to grow peanuts in your own backyard. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. For over 135 years, Burpee has provided gardeners with seeds and plants for everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs. Online at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY. Cloudy skies, 41 degrees in Center City. Winds are out of the west at 17 miles an hour.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. Next Saturday, March 3rd, I'll present 3 workshops at the Delaware Home Show at the Chase Center in Wilmington. Chemical-free lawn care at 11, tomato growing at 1, and correct composting at 3. The Philadelphia Flower Show opens a week from tomorrow and runs through Sunday the 11th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. I'll deliver my annual lecture at the Flower Show and premiere my new book on tomato growing Wednesday, March 7th at 12:30. On Thursday, March 8th, Professor Doug Tallamy will deliver a native plant lecture at 7:30 at Cathedral Village in Roxborough, and I'll appear at the Radnor Memorial Library at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 21st. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
A splendid table comes your way at noon today here on WHYY, followed by Fresh Air Weekend. At 1, Brett McKenzie will join us to talk about writing music for the movie The Muppets. His song, Man or Muppet, is nominated for the Best Original Song Oscar. McKenzie is also half of the musical comedy duo Flight of the Conchords. Also, singer Catherine Russell performs in the Fresh Air Studio. Join us for Fresh Air Weekend at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to the question of the week. What does it take to grow peanuts in your own backyard? We'll take a fascinating long look at this unusual legume, and you will see if you want to try to grow your own this summer. In the meantime, though, a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Nick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you, Mike?
I'm doing well today, Nick. How are you, sir?
I'm very well here in Buffalo, New York.
Oh, okay. Very good. What can we do for Nick up in the frozen north?
Well, I am a collector of beautiful jades, and I had a spectacular jade that probably was 50 years old and maybe 3 or 4 feet high and flowered, and in the midst of some reconstruction in a house that had no heat, we had one very, very cold day, and several big jade plants just drooped and basically the leaves fell off, and many of the big thick stalks that were probably 2 to 3 to some 4 inch diameter just wilted. I'm wondering if there is any hope of bringing these some of them back.
But they were in a closed room, even though the
They were in a closed room, and the closed room had always been heated. We'd bring them out outdoors in the summertime, but we did some construction, so the heat turned off, and we had 2 days well below freezing, and those days did a number on these 2 jades.
Boy, it's just an example of how tropical these plants really are. I mean, it must have gotten darn cold.
But it probably got down around 10.
If we had left you outside during that time period, I think your leaves would have fallen off and you would have...
I think so, too.
You would have wilted as well.
Now, the stalks have gotten very spongy, and then they wilt, and then they basically, you can tell, nothing will ever come back. I just don't know how resilient, or if you have any words of wisdom or counsel that you can give us.
More like a eulogy, I fear.
What
I've seen with these plants is they develop a characteristic thinning of the base of the plant, of the stalk of the plant near the soil line. And to me, that's the sure sign that the plant has lost its life force. Is that what you're seeing?
Well, down at the soil level, it seems to be pretty solid. They're not that spongy thing that I'm seeing at the top of the plant. I mean, this thing, some of these plants were 2, 3, 4, 5 feet, 4 feet high.
Okay, well... Yeah. The effects of frost are always going to, same as you, if you're outside and you're not wearing gloves or a ski mask, the first things of you that are going to get freezing cold are your nose, your ears, your fingers, the furthest parts away from your heart. The same is true of these plants. It's the outskirts. It's the top. It's the furthest branches. So... if the bottom of the plant, where it emerges from the pot, looks reasonably healthy, and you can follow the stalk up, and you get to a point where that changes dramatically, I would prune it off right there.
Okay, that's what I'll do.
What else are you doing? Are you perhaps overwatering them now to compensate?
Well, now I'm not. I haven't watered them in a month because I'm trying to let them dry. Is that the wrong thing to do, too?
Well, you know, these are succulents. They store a lot of water, but they're going to lose water through the cut part. I always go back to the weight of the pot. Does the pot now feel dry, or does it feel...
Yeah, it certainly does. So maybe I ought to water it and see if I can get some... Maybe they're wilting because they don't have any water.
I think that's the case. When you make the cut, you are removing the part of the plant that isn't helping the plant anymore. It's kind of pulling it down. But you're going to have moisture loss through that wound. You don't want to try to seal the wound yourself, but you do want to have adequate moisture in the soil zone at that point.
That sounds just logical, and it sounds like that could help me to stop this thing from continuing to creep backwards.
Yeah, under no circumstances would I unroot them or try to repot them now. That would just be another stress on top of this stress.
Okay, very good.
All right, Nick?
All right, Mike, thanks so much from Buffalo, New York.
Good luck, Nick. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Susan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Susan. How are you?
Great, thank you.
And where is Susan Great?
Louisville, Kentucky.
Excellent, excellent. What can we do for Susan from Kentucky?
Well, I bought last spring something I've always wanted was a redbud tree at a local, you know, not a nursery, but Meyer. And it was in bloom, so I was real happy, planted it. It did great. And then it started getting something was eating on it. Looked like just taking bites out of the leaves. So it went into fall with that going on, and there was a little browning on some of the leaves. So I'm really worried. Is it going to be okay? And what should I do that won't hurt the environment or my animals, you know, cats and stuff?
First of all, we're going to see if there was any damage very soon. You don't have to wait long to see what the health of the tree is like, because with a tree like this especially, the spring bloom and the leafing out will tell you everything.
Okay.
Now, did you actually see anything eating the leaves?
No, I really didn't.
What did the damage look like? Was it little chunks taken out of...
Like little people bites. Half-moon-shaped bites out of the leaves.
From the edges?
Yes.
And how tall was this tree? You said it was a new tree. Was it...
I would say 6.5 to 7, something like that.
There's no chance it was deer nibbling on the leaves?
Oh, no. It was not deer. I live definitely in a subdivision.
Okay. But you never saw any insects either?
No, I looked, and I really didn't see anything.
Is the tree growing out of a lawn, or does it have a nice open area around its base?
It's fairly open around its base, and other than what happened to it, it looks really healthy.
Good.
Got those little tiny buds all over it, ready to, you know, how that they look like they're going to bloom.
That's a good sign, Suze. And is there any mulch at the base?
It's not really mulch. It's more like compost type, you know, stuff. Not a whole lot, but some.
It looked like rich black soil.
Black, yes.
Okay. And not big chunks, but small particles.
No chunks.
Okay. You're welcome to mulch it with compost every spring, starting 6 inches away from the trunk and going out as far as the furthest branch. And have you fed it with anything?
No, I haven't.
Excellent.
I've never done that. So I need
excellent.
To...
Good. No. So far, you're doing good. Okay. And you say it's all budded out, and it looks very healthy.
It does.
Okay, so here's the deal. I would, first of all, do nothing other than maybe put down a fresh mulch of compost again in the spring. That's all, especially with a new plant. What kind of weather did you have last summer in Kentucky? Did you have as wet a summer as we did in Pennsylvania?
It was somewhat wet, yeah. There was plenty of rain.
So there was it wasn't water stress, which you often get with a brand new plant.
No.
Okay.
No.
I would not worry about this one bit, but I can name three things that you can turn to if this starts again.
All right.
Which are all non-toxic to you and animals and things like that.
Good.
The first is a natural insecticide called Neem, N-E-E-M.
All right.
It is very effective against Japanese beetles.
Because it is
both a feeding deterrent. In other words, when you spray neem on the leaves of a plant and a leaf-eating insect comes along, it makes the leaves less attractive. But then if they insist on eating it anyway, they'll die.
Oh, I see.
The other is called spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D, naturally occurring soil organism. You spray on the leaves, and only creatures who eat the sprayed leaves are harmed by the spinosad.
Oh.
Now, I would not spray spinosad when bees are around these plants. Bees could be harmed by it. You want to time your spraying so that bees are not out. You wait till early in the morning before the bees get up, because once it dries on the leaves, it's not an issue for the bees anymore, and the bees are not going to be eating the leaves of the plant. The third would be a clay spray. They make these micronized clay sprays that are called Surround, and you spray that on the leaf of the plant, and it coats it, but that changes the color of the plant. I would look around and have a source ready where you could pick up some neem or some spinosad pretty quickly. And if you start to see damage to your plants, spray them when no bees are around and everybody goes home early. The leaves will be saved and there's no danger to you or any other creatures in your environment.
Thank you so much. This is great, great help to me.
All right. Good luck, Susan.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Can you grow your own peanuts? Producer Alexis Landis, what's our question this week?
Well, Mike, we have a question from Glenna in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania. She writes, I want to interest my grandson in gardening. Can I plant unshelled, untreated, regular peanuts, say, from a supermarket, in a bed where I had potatoes 3 years ago? What do you think?
Well, you can try growing peanuts, but I don't recommend starting with ones from a store for several reasons. Although peanuts are sold in raw form, and despite what you might hear are relatively safe to eat uncooked, especially in small amounts, most packaged store-bought peanuts are likely going to be treated in some way that makes them safer to consume and destroys their viability as seed stock. Roasted and boiled peanuts are, of course, going to be labeled as such. But unshelled and seemingly raw peanuts may have undergone some type of heating or drying process to improve their shelf life and reduce the risk of a very dangerous type of mold to which peanuts are prone. More on this in a little bit. No matter what, peanuts must have their thin skins intact to be viable as seed. Also, peanuts take up a lot of garden space for a long time, and you maximize your chances of getting something edible at the end by planting guaranteed seed of a known type and variety. Perhaps most important, there's a good chance that store-bought peanuts are going to be either, quote, Virginia peanuts or runners. These type produce the really large-sized, quote, nuts that people love, but need a really long growing season to mature, around 150 days of warm weather, which you're not going to get in Pennsylvania in the summer. Heck, you'll have a hard time growing true Virginia peanuts in many parts of Virginia. They're really a crop for areas deeper in the south, like the Carolinas and Georgia. There are early varieties that require less growing time, but store-bought peanuts might not be those early types. And I always tend towards caution when a child's hopes risk being dashed. So order fresh seed. If you have a reasonably long growing season and want those big nuts, look for an early variety of Virginia peanuts. If you have a shorter season, seek out a type that demands much less growing time, like Spanish or red-skinned peanuts, which require about 120 days of warm weather, and Valencias, some varieties of which are touted as being able to produce in as little as 90 days. Early Valencias can allegedly be grown as far north as Canada. And although the vast majority of peanut seed is direct sown after all chance of frost is gone, advanced gardeners who have the ability to successfully start their own healthy, stocky, good-looking plants from seed can gain a good 30 days by starting their peanuts indoors and transplanting them out when the soil is warm. Now, you'd have to grow them in peat pots or some other kind of plant-the-pot-and-all contraption to avoid damaging the sensitive roots. And you really do have to know how to start healthy plants from seed indoors. Garden soil and a, quote, sunny windowsill won't cut it. And neither will most garden soil outdoors. Peanuts are prone to a very dangerous mold known as aflatoxin. And one way to keep this nasty creature at bay is to have superb drainage in your soil. Growing peanuts in heavy clay is not advised. Were I to give this crop a try, I'd mix a big bag of perlite or soil-free mix into one of my best-draining raised beds to really lighten it up. And then I'd be patient. The soil temperature must be at least 65 degrees Fahrenheit. That's measured at a depth of 4 inches. And nighttime air temperatures have to be 55 degrees Fahrenheit or warmer before you can plant seed in the ground directly. Planting in cold, wet soil will virtually guarantee failure. Now some good news. Although we use them like tree nuts, peanuts are legumes. Like peas and beans, they have the ability to take plant-feeding nitrogen right out of the air we breathe. So if you want great yields and serious bragging rights, treat the seed with a peanut-specific inoculant. This natural bacteria will convey that nitrogen-fixing power to the plant's roots. Plant the inoculated seed, unshelled, but with that fragile skin intact, an inch or two deep. If the soil tests acidic, add some lime or wood ash. Peanuts like a soil with a pH of 6.5 to 7, and adequate calcium is important to getting quality nuts. The plants will produce pretty yellow flowers that will then peg or bury themselves in the soil, where they will produce the desired nuts underground. So you can't use mulch on a peanut bed. It would prevent successful pegging. But you can spread a calcium-rich plant food, like one designed for tomatoes, on the surface of the soil mid-season. Cover it with a thin layer of compost to get it working fast. Then, when you reach your variety's maturity date, pull up a sample plant and crack a few nuts. If they come off the plant easily and the inside of the shell is a dark color, they're ripe. Cure your harvest by spreading the nuts out single file in a bright, airy spot until they're dry enough to crack. Keep them dry and use them as quickly as possible. Yes, you can eat a few raw, but roasting or boiling is recommended. No matter what, discard any moldy-looking peanuts immediately and wash your hands well. That aflatoxin is a nasty actor. Well, that sure was an interesting look at the challenging world of peanut growing now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to plant me in heavy clay if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. If you don't know where you live, ask someone. Please put the actual subject in the subject line. The subject is not help or question. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. A spring bloomer that never needs forcing, Alexis Landis produces and co-edits You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Amanda, no relation, McGrath, always blooms on schedule. Forced to work is our editor, Al Banks. I'm equally recalcitrant Mike McGrath, but I'll bloom back in time to see you again next week. If your winter was warm, do you face a severe chance of tomato blight this summer? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll deliver the authoritative answer, plus your fabulous phone calls.
As we bid farewell to February and dust those fusty garden tools, Mike forges ahead with the fundamentals for a fabulous and floral feast for the eyes.